Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Kristin Hansen on her 2018 Routledge publication, Women, Religion, and the Body in South Asia, Living with Bengali Balls. Kristin, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us how this project came about. How did you come about studying these folks?
I had first read about them while I was studying comparative religion at the University of Oslo, but then during summer holidays, I took a job as a organizing a poetry festival in Oslo, and there were lots of people, artists from India, who were invited, and among them were also three singers known as Bells. I didn't really have a chance because I was organizing the festival, so I didn't have much chance to talk to them, but I did hear their songs. And one of the people I met invited me to come to India. And while I was there, I visited a festival, and then I, became interested. Though, actually, I had first made up my mind to study Bollywood movies. And when I grew a bit tired of watching these movies over and over again, which you would have to do if you were going to make that the topic of your dissertation, I gave up the project and decided to relocate to West Bengal, where I met one Bell who recommended that I stay in a village. And so I lived with a family there for 6 months. And then I've been keeping in touch with them through the years since 1987, actually. So it's a longitudinal study, what I've done.
So tell us, what's a ball?
A ball, as I understand it, and as I argue in my book, is a singer-songwriter tradition, Bengali singer-songwriter tradition. The singers, they play handmade instruments, and they sing what a lot of people call folk songs, but many of the songs also have lyrics addressing their esoteric practices about the body, that the body is considered sacred and its substances that it admits is also considered sacred. The Bells live in West Bengal, but they also live across the border in Bangladesh. So Bells can be Muslim or Hindu, and most Hindu Bells are Vaishnav, which is quite a widespread religious complex in Bengal. It means you worship Vishnu, but one of Vishnu's avatars, incarnations, is the cowherder Krishna, who is very popular in that area. And a lot of poor people worship this god and his milkmaid, Radha. Mm.
Now, what do you consider your data for this project? What are you looking at? How are you gleaning your insights?
When I set out to study them, the questions, these people, they are very poor. And one of my naive research questions was, why would anyone who is poor at the outset decide to become a mendicant, a person who lives for alms? And I was also, of course, interested in their beliefs and practices. That I had read an article written by Carol Solomon. And so I wanted to find out if these ideas were actually practiced in the everyday, if people, or if they remained ideals, if one should ingest one's body substances in order to become healthy and rejuvenated, which is what people believe, the singers believe, and also a lot of other practitioners. So I decided to live in a neighborhood with a family. That's also what my supervisors told me to do. So to get a sense of the everyday living, the lived experience of these people, there has been a lot of research carried out on Baals beginning with the start of the last century. But a lot of the research, although it's very good, is based on multi-sided field work and interviews and conversations. And I was interested in observing their daily interaction, how they lived and what it meant to them. Not just in terms of instrumental value, that they earn more money singing songs for alms than they would otherwise if they just simply begged, but why, what motivated them, what was their experience of it, particularly from a women's point of view.
And what did you find out?
What I found was what I mentioned, that Baals are often portrayed as constituting a special sect. They're very famous in Bengal and in Bangladesh because this so-called sect is made up of Muslims and Hindus. So they become a kind of icon, symbol of Bengali unity and symbols of Bengali culture. Rabindranath Tagore, he's also... they were looked down upon, and the poet and Nobel laureate Rabindranath Tagore brought them in from the cold and turned them into models to be followed, in the sense that their lyrics are extremely beautiful and something to be respected. But what I found living in the area was that there weren't clear-cut distinctions between Vaishnavs on the one hand and Baals on the other, or a bounded sect that could be termed Baals, that they are, guru-centered complex, and a guru can have Baals as their disciples can consist of Baals, but they can also consist of ordinary Muslim householders and Vaishnav householders. In fact, Baals are also householders, although they sing for alms. So I try to show that it's much more complex than these sort of neat, distinct categories that one is used to working with in South Asia, where you make a distinction between householders and renouncers, or Hindus and Muslims, Vaishnavs and Shakta worshippers, all these. It's actually much more fluid than that. And there's people, I found that it's more useful to look at the phenomenon in terms of gurus who draw disciples, attract disciples, and that there's a mixture. The disciples can consist of all kinds of people, both Muslims, Hindus, Baals, non-Baals, Vaishnavs. And these disciples learn from the guru, but they have to be initiated. So there are different levels of initiation that all these types of people may go through if they want to.
Tell us a bit about the body in this tradition.
The body is sacred, of course, and they use a lot of terminology also used by tantrics, it's envisioned as a flower garden containing pools of water located in different parts of the body. And these ponds or pools of water are also termed chakras, which we know from tantric religion. The head contains the largest pool of water, and this is where male and female seed is concentrated. And when couples engage in sexual union, they bring the seed from the head down to the genital region, and by means of breath control, they are able to raise the seed back up into the head. It should not leave the body because substances are considered sacred. So this is a kind of, this type of practice, this is what they learn from the guru, but it's considered sacred, so you should not divulge it to people who have not received a training mantra. You need a training mantra in order to learn about these practices. Other substances that the body emits are also considered sacred, such as feces and urine, and these should be taken back into the body. And that's
Sorry, would you consider this a tantric tradition, or would you consider these practices tantric?
I would consider them tantric insofar as they obviously are born out of the same climate or milieu, but they themselves would not call themselves tantric because tantrics dress differently, wear darker shades of saffron. They tend to wear ochre clothes or bright red clothes. Tantrics drink alcohol and eat meat, whereas the people that I study consider themselves Vaishnavas, so they eat fish and milk and should, you know, live off a cooling, subsist on a cooling diet, whereas tantrics eat heated substances. They also worship Kali and Shiv, whereas Vaishnavas worship Krishna and Radha. So they consider themselves quite distinct, but their practices come from the same source, and they obviously mix, meet each other at festivals and exchange knowledge, gurus between each other. So it's not as if they're, you know, separated or.
The group that you study very much evidence what I think of as a tapestry of Hinduism, Indian religions being a tapestry where perhaps historically, certainly within textual boundaries, you can disambiguate, you know, Vedic, Upanishadic, tantric texts, but in practice, really, it's a tapestry. I mean, you'll see various texts and teachings and practices coming together in lived Indian religions in a way that really defies separating out the strands. So it's a really fascinating amalgamation of practices you see in the group that you study. What do you think most surprised you about this research?
Stood out to you,
or what did you find most intriguing or interesting, or what fascinated you the most about this research? About what you found out?
Well, one thing I found fascinating was that how closely related their ideas about body substances and the body as a sacred entity was actually related to dietary practices. What they were preoccupied with was the food they ate, and they were constantly, because they were singers, they believed that when they sang their songs for passengers on trains, they felt that they were conduits for this, that they breathed life into the melodies they were singing, empowering other passengers. And in that process, they believe they lost their energy, that they lost their own vitality, that they lost their balance, their sense of balance. And so they would come home and they would look distraught. They could hardly breathe. They would fall down on the ground, and I would, you know, try to wave a fan and cool them down and bring them water. And so it was surprising to me that they did not resort to ingesting body substances, but instead would try to regain their balance through eating things that they thought were heating, like certain vegetables and garlic and onion, things that would replenish the power that they lost, the vitality that they lost. So that surprised me. Yeah, I thought that body substances were, that they thought of them as a kind of medication. So if you felt unwell, you would just drink menstrual blood, or you would take your urine, but that's not how it worked at all. It was a kind of food they ate. So food was, overshadowed this. Although their guru would keep telling them to drink their urine to regain their strength. But they countered that because they were singing for passengers, they became too weak to be able to do that. That in order to live ideally the way the guru said you have to live, you would have to just beg and not exert yourself as much as singing involves.
Why don't you say a word about the structure of the book?
Well, I thought when I wrote it that I would, a good way to organize the material would be to introduce them and show why they chose this way of life. So I tell their life stories, or they, as they were told to me, in various situations, and describe the people that they knew, their neighbors and other people. So I place them in the village surroundings, and I continue to do that in the second chapter, where I focus on caste, because these people belong to the lower classes of society, and a lot of them are untouchables, as were the family that I lived with. They were untouchables, belonging to the leatherworking caste. And the stigma attached to that, that's also what I describe, that it is, and that the contrast between being untouchable, being viewed as dirty by upper caste, was something that they were extremely ashamed of, but that being a Vaishnav gave them a sense of self-esteem, that it was, that they were very conscious of, that they were purified through becoming Vaishnav, and that the songs they sang were sacred, and their bodies were sacred. So it was it seemed that was part of the reason why they became Vaishnav, not just for instrumental purposes, not just because it was a way of earning money, though that was important too, but also that this was something that they valued, a way of life they valued, to become initiated and to see themselves as pure, clean beings. That answer your question? Then the third chapter, of course, tackles their religious ideas and their practices, and looks at the contrast between ideals and how they're lived. The fourth ties us into the begging, singing songs for alms. I also discuss performances. That's what Baals are known for, of course. That's when they appear in public at festivals and concerts. And the final chapter is about a burial, and a Vaishnav burial, where the people that I knew were in charge And that also shows that the boundaries between Vaishnavas and Baals, if you can speak about boundaries at all, are extremely fluid, that they are Vaishnav in addition to being Baal, and that the ceremonies are what, in a sense, identifies them as religious people, as renouncers, as sadhus, rites of initiation, weddings and burials.
What do you hope people would take away from this book?
I hope the book gives people insight into what it's like to, what poor means, also that one gets an idea of how fluid religious practices are, this interaction between householders and renouncers and mendicants, that they aren't, I mean, people always describe Baals and Vaishnavas as marginalized. And of course they are very marginalized from a middle class wealthy perspective, but they are not marginalized within their own locality. They are poor, struggling, like other poor, struggling, low-caste peasants and other types of construction workers and laborers.
Hmm. Is this a topic that you will continue to research?
Well, yes, there's a lot of points that I would like to elaborate on. So I'm still producing articles about them. And one article that I'm working on now is about, I elaborate on the begging as Baals and Vaishnavas as conduits of the sacred power. And I talk about tantrics, are Vaishnavas, are Baals. Essentially, I would also like to write more about their funerary practices, which is a topic that nobody has addressed before, Vaishnava burial practices.
Cutting edge research. Is there anything else about the book that you wanted to touch on today?
I don't know. Was there anything that impressed you as particular?
Well, it certainly seemed to me that... Obviously, I don't know the scholarship of your subfield, but this seems to be a remarkably understudied group of people. That could just be my own ignorance because I'm not as familiar with your subfield. So I think it's sort of interesting to have a study on so understudied a group of people. And the second thing that intrigued me the most was the extent to which this group really defies categories along the lines of how we teach intro religion, intro Hinduism. Whereas in the life of practice, really and truly, rarely do you see these clean cut categories of Vaishnava, of Shaiva, of tantric practices, of you know, Vedic practices. And this group even pushes that further, it seems to me, where you see bhakti, you see tantric. It's so textured that it really defies categorization along normal, quote unquote, Hindu sectarian lines. That's really what stuck out to me.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad it did. Yes, because that's the point I tried to make. That there is an interaction, because it's not an understudied group. A lot of people have been studying it since for over 100 years, I think, at least 100 years. But as I mentioned, the field work conducted has been multi-sided and based on interviews, and in that sense, you don't get a clear picture of how they fit into their local milieu. If you just talk to the Baals, but you don't talk to their non-Baal spouse or their non-Baal siblings. So what I try to do is provide a social context for the singers and mendicants, whereas others have provided different types of contexts, such as they've looked at a composer's life and shown the composer's trajectory and also interviewed people connected to that composer, who deceased composer, or they've looked at the performance context, but not very many have studied the social context and done that type of field work. So I'm very glad that that point is, that's what you took away from the book. This is good.
Excellent. Excellent. So I suppose we'll close for today. Thank you for appearing on the podcast. For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Kristin Hansen, whose work is available at kristinhansen.com. The website will be in the podcast notes. We've been speaking about her new Routledge book, Women, Religion, and the Body in South Asia. Until next time, stay safe, keep reading, keep listening, and keep contemplating the tapestry of Indian religions. Take care.